questions on Uganda and the similarities and the lessons we've learned. I think there is a certain intellectual, I think it's actually intellectual laziness, where we're always looking elsewhere for constructs that we can fit in our circumstances and therefore apply them. I think we need to do slightly better. Political processes in different countries occur differently because of different dynamics. I think that the Ugandan situation should be studied on its own and how we go forward and what engineering comes forth. And that's why I told you need to study the architects and how they are maneuvering and navigating the political terrain. Prof, I understand and have read your extensive arguments on the question of citizenship and identity. But I think that these questions of citizenship and identity is really to resolve the question of how you relate to the resources, because you don't just exist as a citizen in a political context as an end in itself. It is your status in that context that defines how you'll access rights. For instance, my citizenship defines the fact that I cannot access the United States unless I have a certain visa, and I cannot access health services because I don't have insurance, and so on and so forth. So it will finally come down to citizenship or identity as a definition of how you relate to the resources, and that's the way that I understand it. Finally, this issue of Garang and the question of whether Garang would have actually led the decision to unification. In fact, Madame, there's even an argument that if Garang had been alive, there would have been an election in Sudan before the referendum, which election Garang would have won, and therefore the question of a referendum might quite easily have been postponed. Now, there are two reasons that I will give, which are probably separate from what Professor Mamdani knows. One is that Garang as an individual was the most articulate person on the question of a unified Sudan and an alternative new unified Sudan. And therefore, he represented that particular idea to many people within Sudan, which then brings in the question of symbolism. Number two, we must remember that by the time of the signing of the CPA, he was the single most charismatic Sudanese leader across the country. The rest had just become tribal leaders. That includes Bashir, it includes Turabi, it includes El Mahdi, it includes all the other groups in southern Sudan. He was the only leader. Therefore, from that point of view, he would have commanded the population into staying together. Thirdly, and which is my final point, the Sudanese are not alone in the interest of whether they unify or go separately. There were far too many forces which had thrown in their lot with John Garang that would never have permitted him to push an agenda of separation. Just to name a few, or one or two of them, I know at that point in time, for instance, that the Ugandan government's position was that Sudan should not be divided. The Egyptians had a very strong point of view, and both those countries were willing to back a Garang presidency on condition that Sudan remained united. So you can't ignore those forces. Even if he may have been throwing red meat to his constituents, there was a big issue that actually the referendum could quite easily have been avoided if he had been alive. But as we said, as you rightfully said, we're speculating about what would have happened. We have to deal with what has happened because Garang is not with us anymore. Thank you very much for listening to us.
Thank you. I think it's unfortunate that it would be unfortunate if the discussion boiled down to the person of Garang, because no matter how important, Garang had to relate to a political context and political forces. And I think we need to focus on the context and the forces. I offered two explanations in response to my question as to why the SPLA, which had begun as a movement for unity, ended up as a movement for secession. I offered two explanations. One was leadership. So possibly I'm responsible for directing this conversation more in, you know, to the person of Garang. But second, and that's what I want to underline now, was the learning experience. The leadership also learned from this experience. Garang himself also changed. So I have no way of knowing whether what you said about the last speech is true or not, but I assume it's true. In good faith, and it suggests he learned. It suggests he drew certain lessons from power sharing, which were negative lessons. It suggests that he had reached a conclusion that Southerners would be second-class citizens in a united Sudan, and therefore maybe the only way to go was an independent South Sudan. But it doesn't change the fact that Garang stood for a political and military strategy based on the objective of a united Sudan. And that strategy was successful. It was successful in breaking, in moving through across the boundary between South and the North, in galvanizing border populations in the North. And by the time he reached Khartoum, even in Khartoum. I give you an example, the Ugandan example. During the 1980-1986 guerrilla war, there were two movements in Luwero Triangle competing against one another, the NRM and UFM. UFM believed it would win. Why? Because the UFM leadership was Baganda leadership. Luwero Triangle was in Buganda, and UFM was convinced it would come out on top. The NRM leadership was not predominantly, not from Buganda. The NRM fighters, by the time NRM entered Kampala, 16,000 fighters, of which 4,000 had crossed over from Rwanda at different points as refugees. So purely on this ethnic basis, UFM believed it would win. And yet UFM lost politically in Buganda. Why did it lose? It lost because the strategy and tactics it called for, a head-on confrontation with the power in Kampala, the high point of which was the attack on Lubiri. I remember living on Livingston Terrace, the whole night we could listen to UFM bombarding Lubiri barracks. People were celebrating. Next 2 days, UFM was finished militarily. The head-on confrontation had exposed UFM at its weakest point and had given the government in power a chance to display its strongest side. The NRM strategy, a completely different strategy of guerrilla war, was successful and neutralized the ethnic question, convinced the ordinary Bakopi in Buganda that if you want to be freed of this oppressive power in Kampala, this is the movement to lead. So I'm saying, there's more than ethnicity, there's politics. And let's also think about it. There are lessons to be drawn. Somebody asked, and I think it was polite enough to not say it was a question to me, but he said something like, why don't revolutionaries go and participate in active politics rather than just talking about it? Now look, just retire, okay. So I got it wrong. Okay, thank you. I go to the next one. Eritrea, Ethiopia, Somaliland. Look, it's clear that the nation building project in independent Africa is in a huge crisis. Everywhere, including Uganda, it's in a huge crisis. The background to it is one. Nation building in Africa did not begin with colonialism. It began with independence. The object of the colonial power was to prevent the formation of a nation. That was the whole point of the administrative strategy that I talked about. There are few places where the nation building strategy has been successful. The most successful place, like Robert was saying, is mainland Tanzania under Mwalimu Nyerere. Nyerere is known for, people talk about him, debate him with relationship to Ujamaa, which his economic policy mainly. But I don't think Ujamaa was not his greatest contribution. Nyerere's greatest contribution was that he built successfully the first modern nation in Africa. And he did this by teaching us that unlike what we had been taught, we had confused the state with the army. The state is not the army. The state is really, first and foremost, law. A set of laws which ensure how we live or do not live, and then an administration which ensures that these laws are followed. And Nyerere changed the entire legal structure of Tanzania. He brought to an end the colonial regime whereby each tribe had a separate customary law. And he created a single national law, and to go with it, a single civil administration. And he created this national law from colonial law, from pre-colonial practices, from the practices of the nationalist movement, from customary law, from different sources. But by the time he was done, every Tanzanian lived under the same laws. There were no Abafuruchi in Tanzania. Okay, that's the point. Finally, what lessons do we draw? I don't have a definitive answer, but I just want to say one thing. We have a previous experience from which we need to learn. That's the experience of Rwanda. Uganda, at that time, the NRA, very close relations with the RPA. The RPA was born from within the womb of the NRA. If there's another group with which the NRA has had very close relations, it's the SPLA. Very close relations. But now we're moving from that period of a relationship forged in the course of military struggle, where one side is dominant, the other side is not, to a relationship between two states, where each state demands equality. We didn't learn that lesson with Rwanda. We need to learn it with South Sudan before it's too late. Thank you.
Your attention, you certainly have realized that many people wanted questions answered. We were not able to do that. And now I want to call Michael to come and tell us what will happen to those questions, because we certainly need to continue this dialogue. But of course, what is most important is that we should be able to answer the question, where do we go from here? But even as we discuss South Sudan, it is important that we place the